title and things on the app that would because it would be on Thursday, April 29th, 2021, and getting this one out at 6. Apologies for the late start this morning to our presenters. We had our first late floor session this year, so we're trying to look at it. I'm present my representative Carr and my fellow proponents of the future. The program will have to be required to conduct business. For those who are going to be able to sign up your cell phones, and those of you who are not late to remain on mute if you are not speaking. Before we begin, I would like to thank Jamie Clare, the House Tribal Affairs Secretary of Reference, and Marcia Turret from the General Lawyer for staffing the committee today. Today, we will be hearing presentations on the topic of tribal contracting in the area of education with representatives from Coastal Africans Institute, the National Education Association, and the Chamberlain Village Traditional Council. First, we will be hearing from Coastal Kiyak Barbara Blake, the Coastal Africans Institute, which Blake, if you could introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, you sound great.
My name is Martha Kiyak Barbara Blake. I serve as the director of the National Policy Center for Coastal Africans Institute. I currently here residing in the Santa Cahini, otherwise known as Juno, and I want to thank Representative Zarkowski and the other members of the Tribal Affairs Committee for allowing me to speak here this morning. It's truly, truly honored to come and get to see their wonderful faces. I wanted to start with a quick story, if you would indulge me. My son and I moved back to Alaska when he was just entering kindergarten. At that time, he had gone to a school back in Washington, D.C., where I was working in the office of the Secretary of Agriculture at the time. He went to a school back in D.C., a Montessori school, and so thinking in my head, we're from Alaska, we're indigenous to Alaska, this is going to be an easy transition back to Alaska. But they entered into a school that had no reflection of our Native people. I was quite shocked. I won't tell you where we moved, but when I moved back, I entered this elementary school, and you couldn't tell Native people existed anywhere. There was no representation of them as Indians. There was no representation of them in the classroom. It was as if Native people did not exist. The curriculum definitely did not work like this. And I saw my lovely little cute chair boy go from somebody who was very outgoing to somebody who was reserved, to somebody who did not want to go to school, to a place where he was struggling and fighting against an institution that did not reflect who he was. We moved to Juno a few years later, and he was entering into the second grade at this point. And we walked into this school, and the first thing he saw on the wall was a picture of Elizabeth Crabtree. And as we were walking down the hall, we saw paintings and artwork by students that represent their representation of indigenous artwork from around the state. I walked to this classroom door, and written in their Hakka language was Welcome Class 2024, and written in English was below it the same exact thing. And I walked into this classroom, and not only did he have the ABCs in English on his board, but he also had the ABCs written in the Hakka language. And I saw my little boy, from somebody who was reserved, somebody who disliked school, somebody who did not want to be there, to somebody who loved school. He was so excited to be in that space. He flourished. He was represented. And I know it had everything to do with their ability to show the world that, yes, you are important. That who you are matters to us. Enough to represent you on these walls, enough to represent you in this classroom, enough to ensure that you are represented and feel welcome here. I wanted to start with that story because it makes a difference when our kids can see themselves reflected in the world around them. And when they don't, there's trouble. When they cannot connect with who they are, when they cannot connect with everything they know about who they are, they have a difficult question. So thank you for letting me start with that story. It always helps the family, but it also helps its own real life data too. And giving you some example of a person or a human being. So like one of our own kids in these systems who is struggling but is trying to make it. We know, and you'll hear later, I'm sure from Commissioner Johnson and others, that our current system is just not working for our kids. More often than not, that first description of a slow that I gave you is the description of a slow that people see. What our kids are experiencing in school that does not reflect who they are. Contacting is a solid solution, but only if it's done incorrectly. I wanted to really quickly talk about how I see the difference of contacting and contracting, just to give some handles on the differences between what I think is being proposed and what could potentially happen. As I see it, contacting, there's a big difference between contacting and contracting. With a contract, I recognize you as a sovereign. You and I are going to enter into a formal agreement, and as a sovereign, I'm going to treat you as a sovereign. We have all the outcomes that we're expecting, but how you get there is dependent on how you know how best to take care of the people within your care. That's a contract. I'm not dictating to you every single step of the way and micromanaging your ability to function in that system because I recognize you as a sovereign. You're contracting, given a different experience. You and I are entering into a contract. I want you to achieve certain outcomes, and I want you to achieve them by following A, B, C, and D. This is how you're going to get there. I'm going to dictate to you exactly how you're going to get there. You're going to ask me permission for any changes or waivers in that contract. And there's a big difference between how you can get someplace with the flexibility that is allotted through a contract, from a contract agreement and a contract agreement. I'm just trying to say that contracting is what the VTS does currently runs under. And I'm going to leave it at that. I wanted to give you a few examples of successful contracts that currently exist, and I'm sure you've already heard them. I know that when Rob and I presented earlier this year, we talked about the Enable Service for our state, otherwise known as ANCHC, South Central Foundation, all of the lot of other regional health organizations that operate in our state. But originally, Enable Service was the primary care for our doctor needs. That original example of healthcare had something like this, just to give you an example of what my mental care is going to look like as a kid. They run under the Enable Service, they run under the federal government. And we were living in Anchorage at the time, so we go to IHS facility in Anchorage, downtown Anchorage. And we walk in for our teeth cleaning as kids, and there would be a big plastic table set up. We'd have like multiple chairs sitting around the table, and in front of each setting, there would be a toothbrush, toothpaste, dental floss, mouthwash, and a little bit of fluoride. And the dentist would sit at the head of the table, and he'd look at all of us native kids sitting around this giant plastic table, and he'd say, "Now pick up your toothbrush, brush your teeth. Pick up your dental floss, and floss your teeth. Now rinse and apply the fluoride." And that's how they used to clean our teeth as kids. How many of you would let your kid go into a dentist and allow that to be the type of teeth cleaning that is acceptable? Right? None of us would allow that. Because we know it didn't work. It was not a successful treatment for our kids to this teeth. But then you look at today, and you look at what was able to be accomplished under the tribal authority, tribal contracting of our Enable Service, of this giant, massive organization that operates so intricately throughout our state. And we have some of the most amazing buildings taking care of our kids' state. We have industry by actually taking out those fancy tools and doing the cleaning that is necessary to keep our teeth clean from cavities and to keep them free of other bacteria that can harm our kids' themselves. And I wanted to bring that into the room because we know about it, that there are successful examples out there. But I also wanted to mention here that just because we have clinics One more example I wanted to give you of contact being done well is through our tribal transportation dollars. Our tribal transportation dollars come into our tribes and it's a contract. Not a contract, it is a contract. Allowing tribes to function within their spaces in a tribal transportation program that has gone above and beyond to not only take care of just tribal spaces, but also non-tribal spaces. They've been able to enter into successful agreements and create and be creative and flexible to work with city and municipal governments to achieve some pretty amazing feats. We're talking about new docks and places, maintenance of roads that otherwise weren't able to be able to be taken care of because of the lack of funding by municipal or city government. And so there's some really solid examples out there. How the state, how the municipal governments, how the federal government can work with our tribes in a contract in recognizing that government to government relationship that we have, and any opportunity that is either death served them, and that is to serve all of our kids. We do our best to make sure that all of our kids are represented in our schools. I do want to say that with the current contract, the current legislation that you have before you, there's always room for improvement, and this one is definitely one of those instances. It's a great start. I think there needs to be additional trust building that needs to take place between the state of Alaska and our tribes before anything moves any further. There's been a lot of trust lost in the last few years, and I think that there needs to be instance that needs to be continued trust building for anything to come to fruition, but also needs to reflect better the government to government relationship that tribes in the state of Alaska have. The current bill decides that it needs to do a little bit more in that recognition of that relationship and the recognition of a contract, which is a contract.
Thank you for being here with us here. I have any questions from committee members? And just for the record, this is an initial hearing on concepts and dialogue around contracting and economic education. Unfortunately, just due to schedules, we've not been able to take Commissioner Johnson here, but I know he's very committed and his office is really excited about participating in these conversations. But we wanted to get started on putting something on the record since there's been a lot of dialogue around what education contracting could be in the city of Alaska. But I wanted to make sure that we had an opportunity as a committee to hear from community members that are interested in this particular area. Representative Carr. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just really appreciate your comments this week this morning. I just want to make a little bit of a plug. We have a bill of House Bill 173. It's a very point you made, you know, that it makes a difference when kids see themselves and, you know, want to be in a school environment where they feel like they're meant to be. And this House Bill 173, our school climate and school connectedness bill, is about addressing that very issue and about cultural competence in our public school system and incorporating Indigenous values and then also restorative practices, which, even though I learned about them only a few years ago, comes from Indigenous practices as well. Anyway, just, you know, contracting, I fully support. This is something we're trying to work on to improve the public school system so that, you know, all students that are still participating in the public school system would be in an inclusive school environment, because that is foundational to a student's learning experience and success. And unfortunately, like your son, too many of our students have that experience where, for one reason or another, they don't feel like a part of our school community and then as a result don't succeed. So I hope you'll take a look at that, because I really appreciate any feedback you have about that. I also look forward to continuing the conversations about the opportunities with contracting and look forward to just learning how we can support the best path forward. I know that first off, the Institute has been in and facilitate dialogues with the department on opportunities for what education with impacting Alaska could look like. As part of those discussions, and I also saw that I am also a member of the education committee as a school designated group, and we heard a lot about the turnover of teachers in rural hub or village communities across Alaska, whether it's teachers or administrators. We hear a lot of data about standardized test scores and how students may not be prepared to perform academically in a school environment. Can you talk a little bit about what you may envision compacting looking like, what those types of agreements might be modeled after in terms of being able to bring about improvements in some of those areas?
I think there is a beautiful model to be made with how the tribal health system operates in our state. Yes, our tribal institutions come together, our tribal health organizations come together to negotiate annually and have a conversation with one another, but how they deliver those programs is dependent upon the region, it is dependent upon the community. And that's because our communities, our regions, are not the same. We recognize that. And as Alaskans, we all know that the geography is different from Alabama as Georgia is to Mexico. And so when we're thinking about these different communities in our state, we know that the application of our education system cannot be one single education system. So I see the ability of growth and flexibility in these spaces to be able to flex to the community itself to demonstrate to the students and also develop a level of care for teachers. Not to say that the current system doesn't have a level of care, but when we're trying to operate in a level of care, we're operating from the top down. It becomes very challenging to operate in a successful manner when you have, over 300 communities, rural communities, a state that you are trying to take care of. It becomes a challenge for anybody. If you operate those systems differently, as being presented here through the compact, you are essentially taking an approach that allows that community to engage in a space that they are familiar with, but also to be able to uplift the system that they can put forward, because they are not living for 10,000 years. These communities have lived in the same locations, and they are not going anywhere anytime soon. I just would like to say, who's going to know better how to take care of the community, how to take care of the students, how to take care of the people who come into their care, other than the people who have lived there, hoping that they're providing for future generations. I see that as an increase in not only retention, just like not only their care for teachers, but also the increase in student scores. I had a good friend who got his PhD at American University, and his dissertation, he's a Native man, and his dissertation was completely on how Native kids would draw information. And this can be applied to anybody, but to any one individual. In order to absorb the information, these Native kids that he interviewed and that he had discussions with had to make it relevant to their culture before they could absorb the information. There was even one instance where one of the Navajo students would go as far as translating all of this information into Navajo before he could understand it in the way that was being presented to him. In order to get those lessons lines across, we have to start asking our kids to continuously paralyze themselves in order to absorb information.
Thank you for that. And just a quick housekeeping item before the next question. I'm sorry, I've talked to you, is that 8:30 p.m. and your service has been set at 8:25 a.m. Another question is and we will also be hearing from the representative from NEA. We have extended some invitations for school districts are doing
Good morning. Thank you, Ms. Sims, for the opportunity to be before Travel First Committee today. For the record, my name is Tom Kleiner. I'm a 25-year-old teacher in Alaska, currently serving as an NEA legislative president. Now, first and foremost, I'd like to acknowledge and call you to testify from the place of Old Anchorage, which of course has been built upon denied land. But NEA Alaska, we've adopted the practice of starting all of our own meetings with Native Land Acknowledgement. As part of our commitment to racial and social justice for our students, we value this practice for several reasons. Not only is it important to acknowledge and pay respect to the Alaska Native ancestors upon whose land we live and work, but we see it as an opportunity to educate our own members on the history and the contributions of Alaska's First Peoples for which we benefit. All too often, this rich history has been suppressed in the telling of the story of America. This moment of reflection helps guide our work in the meeting by reminding us of the shared values common amongst Alaska Native cultures. In this discussion, and in all of our conversations, it's my hope that we laws on that, empowers back to others, as each person has something unique to contribute. And some of this language I pulled from, I think, the Austin and Rawls network, that Rawls in such a profound way spoke to me. And so these are the testimony. Let me start what we have as giving Macy Jones imagery. Having patience, sometimes something cannot be rushed, and take care of others because we cannot live alone. Today, it seems especially important as we discuss the future of public education in Alaska to be guided by the needs of our communities today and also mindful of the impact that our work has on future generations who will become stewards of this place after us. Since this is the first time I've testified before this committee, and I don't know that everybody knows me well and had an opportunity to meet in person for some of you, I want to take just a brief minute and introduce myself. I'm an Eagle River High School social studies teacher at ISD. I came to Alaska with the United States Air Force in 1989. And I was living and working on what was called Underdorf at the time, now Joint Base Underdorf Richardson, when I found my calling to be a full-time educator after I volunteered to teach Sunday school at Church and Base. I got out of service, in fact, early to stay in Alaska, and I used the GI Bill to attend UIA. And got hired in 96, and now I'm a 25th year of public education in Alaska. And now, having been elected by my colleagues across the state, I'm serving as an Alaska president. So it's in that capacity that I'm here this morning on behalf of almost 12,000 educators across the state who represent the vast majority of classroom teachers, classroom teacher and custodians, and many of them. Educators in our schools who have first-hand expertise in delivering lessons and creating environments conducive to student learning. As Alaska's professional educators, we're committed to policies that promote educational equity, social justice, and high-quality educational opportunities for Alaska students no matter where they live. Alaska's educators are grateful and honored to be included in conversations around tribal contracting for education. We are absolutely committed to the deep vision for public education in Alaska. Our own values and family members who work diligently to reach, teach, and inspire as we work to provide an excellent education for every student every day. Our values and principles that we bring to the public policy table as educators are focused on the learning and success of our students. I'm happy to briefly share those values, hopes, and identify a few areas of concern for us, but quite frankly, I also recognize that we have much to learn, and I'm here to listen. I'll start by saying that many Alaska members believe that public education is a fundamental civil right, in fact, a human right. And while the history of public education in Alaska is extremely tarnished by racism, cultural oppression, and colonialism, we're here to work to make sure those atrocities are there in the past. Our members are actively engaged in the work of trying to dismantle any and all systems of oppression to prevent children from accessing a public education, a great public education, and we pledge to continue to address the legacy of systemic racism inherent in our institutions and actively work to eliminate any vestiges of that cancer which may continue to persist today. We're on the front lines working to do and to be better. We have fought hard for cultural responsiveness to be embedded in all curriculum. We fought against the overuse of culturally biased, nationally known, standardized tests. And we are working to recruit and retain more ethnically and culturally diverse educators so that the faces in the front of our classrooms better reflect those looking back from the seats. We need to make sure that student and family voices are heard and that our focus is centered on creating welcoming and affirming schools that do not just acknowledge our lasting native cultures, but actually work to protect and preserve them by sustaining and restoring traditions, languages, and culture. Educators want to be a partner in exploring the policies that will lead to the best outcomes for our students. We are honored and humbled to be with you here today. I'll say that, you know, many of the members have been engaged with this tribal contracting policy conversation through the Alaska Education Challenge. But thank you again, Representative Kosky, for welcoming us as a continued partner in this dialogue. We're supportive of the broad outlines that we've heard, particularly as related to tribal authority and local control. NEA Alaska control of education is critical. We know that students are best served by schools which meet the needs of the local community. We cannot be accomplished without genuine, sustained community and parental involvement. Tribal Compact could provide the authority and force needed to create schools which truly reflect the values and cultures of the community they serve. As this discussion progresses, we hope to address transitions and the impact on existing public schools, and we hope that partnerships and sustainability will be considered. I was pleased in reading a deep statement on Compact in Education that says, and I quote, in accordance with the Massachusetts Constitution, the state tribal education compact schools will be public schools that are open to all students later than our native right, end quote. In addition, Alaska has a strong tradition of protecting workers, and as such, Alaska's educators recognize and value the importance of collective bargaining rights. This means educators manage and have agency over employment contracts and the ability to negotiate with their employers on wages, hours, and other terms and conditions of employment. We believe that collective bargaining gives educators that voice to advocate for themselves and on behalf of their students, just as I'm doing right now. It's through this process that DA Alaska has worked to attract and retain the best educators for its students. Push back on unnecessary testing to increase instructional time, provide more nurses, health aides, counselors, social workers, mental health professionals, and insist on local control for schools, proper school funding, and advocate for racial and social justice. Collective bargaining for public educators offers an organized and transparent system to improve student learning and the overall environment in public schools. Alaska's educators would respectfully recommend that any kind of Compact for Education or related policy not inhibit in any way educators' ability to collectively bargain. It is this very process, in fact, that helps us support and ensure the best possible education for all of our students and communities across Alaska. The conviction that local communities are best situated to address the educational needs of students is foundational to Alaska's system of education. Accordingly, we believe that a tribe has greater ownership and local control over education, student outcomes in their communities will improve. As a result, all Alaska students and their communities will benefit from this kind of self-determination and the new innovative educational opportunities which may be provided by Compact. Thank you so much for your kind attention. I'm available for questions if there are any, and I look forward to our continued dialogue on this planning work issue.
Thank you, Mr. Clemmer, for joining us today and for those very thoughtful comments. We have a lot of the comments and any written comments that you have prepared, just to refer back to you if that's possible. Representative Field has a question.
Thanks, Mr. Clemmer. Does any of you represent teachers and local school districts?
I'd have to double check to be sure, but I do believe so. I'm sure I can get a text from a staff member to confirm that. If there's one question.
I think so, and I believe that because I fully support going down the road that Tribal Compact and certainly protecting open bargaining rights in the process. But I guess I'm also curious, that's one option, and other options to increase local staff in schools.
Thank you, Dr. Not really a question, but just a comment. I just really appreciate, hearing, this sounds like a really a willingness on the part of an organization, because sometimes large organizations are slow to change. Your comments about racial and social justice, and just we have so much work to do in that area, and in terms of equity and education and how foundational education is to succeeding in life. We just really appreciate that you know, we're acknowledging that today and on this talk that we'll be doing a lot more policy to address that.
Over the course of your participation and dialogue on the opportunities for education contracting in Alaska, what has been your understanding of how that dynamic might look in a particular community or region? How that would look maybe at a bird's-eye level, maybe down to a more granular level at the school, at a community level. I think it's helpful to get your perspective. One, as an educator, that evaluates policy, but two, as a classroom teacher. So what has been your understanding of how that might look and the types of questions or opportunities that have been bright spots in that?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the question. I think I'm going to answer it by not answering it. It's in the sense that that's not for us to determine. We really value that local control. And I think no matter, we work really hard, as I said, to embed cultural responsiveness into our curriculum to reflect that. But despite the best efforts of the best people involved in education all throughout the ranks, through superintendents and school boards, I think there's a fundamental flaw inherent in the system of, you know, sort of putting that square peg in a round hole, in that the self-determination that would be provided by compacting is the only way to do that the way it ought to be done, to truly reflect the culture, not just being culturally responsive, but to revitalize, to preserve that, you know, not to just reflect the richness of the history and that sort of thing, but to be, to combating and self-determination that is provided there is probably that missing piece that's going to help some of our Alaskan schools that operate differently as a result, make that difference. And as I was spoken to in testimony earlier, so that kids really are invested in their education because their education is reflected back at them, that it is there, that they see themselves, that there are more, it becomes embedded in everything they do, in the community, in their identity, that they educators, we feel this will make it more attractive for more people to stay in their local areas and teach and work and help the future generations. And if this is the potential of creating that cyclical sort of improvement that becomes self-reinforcing. So how that looks in each community, I can't say. It's not for me to say. It's for the local community to develop that, and I think that's where the value is.
Thanks for that. Piggyback on Representative Field's previous question, has it been your understanding that there could be a spectrum of what compacting could look like in a particular environment where in some areas it may be particularly focused on a lighter scope of work or agreement where in some areas it may be more sophisticated and have a higher level of penetration and impact?
Yeah, I think that speaks to the heart of compacting, that each entity in community will create their own compact and the state needs to be flexible in those agreements to allow the best situation to exist in each local community, and that some of them will be more encompassing than others. But that's for those local leaders to determine.
Perfect. Thank you.
after these standardized tests. And so I kind of was the guinea pig and, you know, was able to observe myself as the guinea pig in these tests. And it was a fascinating and really awesome experience because I was able to do standardized tests basically because I was doing a test break on it. There's parents who had to do it. So the test did a really good job testing whether I was doing a test break on his parents had to do it. So it was a decision on the status and promoted me to a working in the standardized system. And it was just really sad to see schools with kids who are talents and actually have a background in school poorly. But in the standardized system, apparently it's a puzzle to beat up teachers, to beat up schools, for basically since we have a long problem, so they have nothing to do with the quality of the education system. So, you know, one of the questions I have around contacting is the ways that you can contact and allow us to focus on instruction and helping kids and get away from this really perverse paradigm where I think the primary function of standardized testing is actually just a paradigm for schools. From what I've seen, it has nothing to do with increasing quality of instruction. So I don't understand the metrics between contacting and standardized testing. I would like to hear more from standardized testing questions and but perhaps contacting is in a vehicle toward that end. And of course, the goal is to make sure that kids have as equal an opportunity as possible, whether they come from a wealthy or hard school background.
Somebody in the Midwest, that's a student rather than the
so what is one student with additional knowledge performing above the expectation of what's being measured in that test who is told to go wrong? They're essentially punished for that local knowledge that they have acquired through their life, through their existence. And so we've got to find a way. One of the difficulties, I guess, in at the heart of your question is a lot of these testing standards are federally required. There are some at the state level that compacting could probably address more easily, but if the compact is with the state government, the federal assessment requirements would still apply. And so that is going to continue to be a problem. And so if at the state level, perhaps there's some room for flexibility around testing where we measure what skills and knowledge kids have and we base some of those requirements of the knowledge and skills that we want them to have on local learning, on traditional cultures, on how much natural science exists in hunting and fishing and identifying flora and fauna, how much art is there, how much history is there. And not enough of it credit is given for knowing their own history, their own art, their own science, their own environment. And the discussion around testing is clearly one that will continue to have to be addressed, and we're happy to be there to help those folks. Thank you for having me.
Next, we'll hear from Lisa Wade, who is a woman by the Judiciary Council. Ms. Wade, please introduce yourself for the record. And we have Sacker that will be answering slides. So go ahead and just let us know when you've been consulted to the local side.
Right, so I'm going to tell you about the fact that I'm talking about the fact that I'm going to talk to you about the fact that I'm going to talk to you about the fact that I'm going to talk to you about the fact that I'm going to talk to you about the fact that Hi everyone, my name is Lisa Wade. I am the Health, Education, and Social Services Division Director at Chick-fil-A Village. I'm also our Council Secretary. And I get the really wonderful pleasure of being with you today to try and give you an example of a school that I think is doing exceptionally well and a great example of what compacting would look like for us. And I want to say I'm really honored to be with you and I really appreciate that you're all taking this on. I was really inspired by the previous comments. So just before that simple PowerPoint, I apologize. I think I inundated you with information right last night. A couple of the things that I sent to you, I would like to share. One of them is an example of our network last year, which I really hope you get the opportunity to look at that, because I think that speaks to what Mr. Kramer was just talking about, the individual experience of learning, in a way that combines our traditional lifeways with cluster economics. And so, I also provided to you kind of a glimpse of what our school looks like. We just recently went through a renovation, and I'll show you the evolution of our school in this little PowerPoint presentation. So you can go ahead and advance the next slide. So for those of you that don't know where we're located, we are in Chickaloon. However, our school is just 8 miles north of Palmer. And it is the first tribally operated school in the state of Alaska. So are you guys hearing feedback? I hear feedback.
We are not hearing feedback. And sometimes when you first get started talking, it starts and then it goes off.
Okay, thanks. The school is the first tribally operated school in the state of Alaska. And you can go ahead and advance to the next slide. So I think it's really important to share a little bit about Chickaloon Village in addition to talking about our school, because our mission as a tribal government is to help our citizens to thrive. We were formally recognized passed back in 1982, and that was reaffirmed again in 1993. Over our traditional government systems and our educational system, of course, goes way back to time immemorial. Go ahead. Next slide. So I wanted to share with you really quickly the Yogyakarta school origin story. You can advance the next slide, please. This is my grandmother, Catherine Wade. She was our great grandmother, and she's been unfortunately no longer with us. But she's really the reason that our school is in existence today. Back in 1989, you can advance the next slide. You can see on that slide, right up on the hill is where the local correctional facility is in our community. And our school is 2 miles from that correctional facility. And back in 1989, we invited to go up to that correctional facility to support cultural activities because it was very disproportionately impacted by mass media up there. And so they wanted to connect them to culture. So we would go up and sing and dance with them. We would meet with them and do other activities with these men, and we developed relationships with them. And they would come out of the correctional facility, and she would invite them to come sing with us at our house. And they would come and cut wood and do some of the cultural things there. But inevitably, a lot of them would end up back on that hill again very quickly. And she got really frustrated with that because she said, they're lost, they don't know who they are. That's been taken from them. They've forgotten where they've come from, and they don't know their true self, and they've lost something. So we have to start with our kids, our babies. We have to start teaching them who they are from a very young age so that they grow up and are successful in this world. And so she started by teaching Saturday lessons, which really were all wrapped around teachings, which many of our teachings just means ancient legends. And she started sharing stories with our family members. And her parents were driving from Anchorage to come do this, and they found it to be so successful that they wanted to form an actual school. So you can go to the next slide. So from the very beginning, the school was really founded in our active values. So it is the cornerstone, the center of our school. Every one of these values are shared with our students. They're taught what they mean. They live these values in their actions, in their words, and in their language, because we are a language survival school. Yeah, the language is one of the considered an endangered language. So we have a strong language preservation component built into our school. You can go on to the next slide. This is a way back photo showing you in 1992 when they started singing and dancing to the magic drum. And I want you to see the young man that's on the right-hand side of that that's holding that drum. He was one of the first students in the school. And this is a little bit later than 1992. This is around 1999. So he'd been going on for a while. But that young man started in that school. Go ahead and advance to the next slide. And between 1992 and now, Harvard actually recognized our school as an innovative school, not just for the state of Alaska, but for the nation, because they recognized that we were doing something well there, which was creating opportunities for our people to learn a way that was actually teaching them not only Western academics, but also teaching them sovereignty and how to become leaders, future leaders in our community. Go ahead and go on to the next slide. So in 1999, my mother was saying that we're going to move out of the driveway that she used to own, this old building, we called it the mouse house. And she wanted a little red schoolhouse. And so we built this little tiny red schoolhouse. And when it popped out, there were 12 students. They were bursting at the seams. You can see where it's very small. And then they decided they were going to build this other schoolhouse. So we took that along, and we actually purchased and built this schoolhouse as a community project. So the community built the schoolhouse, both of those, actually. So you can go ahead again. So this is a picture of our education department a little bit closer to now. And we actually, again, were going up the seams. And part of the reason for this is that, you know, we are getting students, not our own tribal citizens necessarily, actually the place now where I have to turn children away from our school. It's a really, it's a sad place for me to be because I know how powerful our school is for our students and how safe and how welcoming it is. And it's a family situation. So I want to share with you, you know, an example of what recently happened. You know, because of COVID, we've been operating from a very safe place and a secure place, and we decided we were not going to take on any new students this year. And so we operated from the same student base that we had last year. It was really difficult because I turned away probably 20 families that wanted to come to our school this year. Fast forward to February, and I got a call from the mother who said, my kids are getting bullied really badly in school. And they've been called gun Indians. And is there any possibility that we can move them into your school? And I searched my heart, and I could not say no to that because that was kind of my situation growing up, was experiencing bullying at that level in schools. And I wanted to see if we could help. So we absorbed those students into our school. And on the first day of school, this 13-year-old boy came in, and I was giving him a math placement test just to see how I could fit him in into what his individual learning needs were. And he put his head down on his desk. And I let him sit there for a minute, and I went up to him, and I said, hi, what's going on? What are you doing? And he goes, how do I do this? And I said, well, you know, sometimes you have to do things you don't want to do, and this is going to help me to help you. So can you just try it? If you don't know the answers, that's totally okay. I just need to know what you know and what you don't know. And he said, I'm not going to do it. And I said, well, what are you going to do? And he said, I'm going to get expelled. And I said, is that your goal? And he said, yeah, that's what always been my goal in schools. I hate school. And I said, well, for one thing, we're in the wrong school because we don't expel kids. We have something we call aunties who are going to give you consequences and love you. And they're going to love you until you're in school. And I said, come take a walk with me. And we went outside, and for 10 minutes, we talked about leadership, and we talked about opportunities, and we talked about the fact that I can offer him a job this summer through my other programs, and that we can wrap around him to make him feel safe, and that he can trust us. And fast forward now, we're in our second week of school, and it's a totally different kid. He's engaged, he's doing all the activities, he's doing his academics. He comes over to show me, look what I did today. And I think that's just one example of the magic of our schools. And I don't share that to disparage the public school system. I just know that for some of our kids, like, this approach, this school, is a safe place. It's a healing place for them. And it's hard to describe that to you in pictures. We'll have you go to the next slide, please. And I hope you see that the person who was driving was that same student that came up from our school. And the magic of that school is that not only do we have students that are progressing through and becoming successful in careers, one of our students is going on to become a registered nurse. Another one of our students is going on to become a GIS technical expert. He does things I don't even understand. And so they're having success in those ways, but they're having success in many ways. This is a picture of our renovated school. We reached 20 students, and we have one room school house, and we're blowing out the walls, and so we added on to that school. Go ahead and go to the next slide. And the reason I shared with you the presentation about the construction of that school, because one of the things I think is really important for you to understand is that we are a community, and everything we do is with a community focus. So from building our school, you can see the very first slide within that school project construction paperwork I sent you was a visioning that was held with the community. Everything is in partnership with the community. We have a parent committee that guides us through how we're teaching kids. And that's how we build the trust with them, allowing us to teach their kids. So our school right now is a homeschool that's partnered with the Matsonville School District. And I say partnered because it goes bi-directional. I think that's really the benefit of what we're making an offer, a bi-directional approach at learning. So an example of that is that our teachers come in and help us guide our teachers with curriculum selection and kind of measuring successes, things like that. And then I have partnered with them to help with the Indian Ed Department and other parts of the Matsonville School District perform the role to help to bring in those cultural elements that they are avoid of or having trouble locating. So an example of that was that this school unit, the Matsonville School District, they decided they wanted to recognize the students in the Indian Ed program to be able to you know, have something recognizing the bill for the program when we graduate. So I took that as an opportunity to bring the Indian education graduation coaches together at one time and to do a beta lesson, the one that we give our students, around the values of putting together a special piece of the data based on the school colors of the school and talking about the prayers and wishes that are put into creating those gifts to give to the students. And then they're being given to all of the students so they have a piece of the data to our graduation. And so we would love to share more and do more partnership together. Our school currently has 22 students. We have capacity for 30. That's just a breakdown. We have three different classrooms right now present. And honestly, we're already blowing up the seams and ready for more space. That is currently how it's structured. The challenge with that is that it would be resolved through contracting, as it has taken me, I've been doing the school, administering school since 2012. It has taken me that amount of time to get them to understand the value of cultural education and to incorporate that into the learning plans because it has been really a complicated relationship through several principals, several teacher advisors, and I think that's the challenge that we come up against that contracting could resolve. Now, I currently administer our IHS compact, and I'll be negotiating that again this month, actually, in May. And so I structure all of those compacts with Indian Health Service. I work with them. This one we're ratified to add in a public health response to COVID. And basically what it is it's me going back to the IHS to say, we want to add in this extra component into our existing agreement. This is what we're telling everybody to be doing. They review it, they say that sounds good, and then our funding dollars that come through are allocated to that. So it's less of a we have to prove the worth of our cultural education to you.
I have a follow-up question based on this particular slide. Can you speak to how we had a conversation a moment ago when I heard Mr. O'Reilly's testimony about standardized testing and assessment of students? Can you talk about how that layered into your environment?
Yes, absolutely. That's a really important topic to me. And just to give you an example, I have a daughter with special needs. And her first assessment was when I started doing this work. And I brought her in for an assessment, and one of the things they did is they put a bunch of shiny pencils off to the side of her, and they tried to get her on tests, and they were focused on the alphabet at the time. And I had to explain to them, she's FAS, and you cannot lay out those things like that in the distractions and as much as you do on all tests. Let me show you what she knows how to do. And I was able to show them in a way that they could see progress in their learning. And so, you know, it is an ongoing challenge with us that the MAP testing and the PEAKS testing and all of these different testing options because they are not normalized for Native kids. And it's really problematic when we're talking about special education. students, and they've said, this Native Alaskan, and the parents stopped them and said, wait, they're an Alaskan Native person. And they went on to just talk about this deficit, all these deficits that this student had. And, you know, I had to stop them and say, I want to recognize something here. First of all, these tests that you are basing your information on are not learned by their kids. And you need to preface that in the conversation that you have with parents, that this is just a tool, one simple tool. And then this is not the whole of the picture. And so really what we try and do in our school is we do have them take the tests, but we recognize they're only a small part of it. And so we work to show through examples all the ways they're learning. And really, that's the best approach because it's individualized for the student. I was one of those kids that would circle the bubbles to make a pretty picture. I didn't care about taking those tests, and a lot of our kids don't. They don't see the value in being assessed like that. And so it's not a good indicator of what children know, honestly. Okay, go ahead to the next slide. I guess the one thing I want to share with you is our school is not exclusive to just our county systems. It is open to everyone. I think right now we have one Alaska Native students, and in the past we've had one Alaska Native students. Because what we recognize as a people is that what's good for our kids is good for all kids. You know, when we live in a community, we can't be healthy as a people in a community that isn't also being raised up to be healthy as well. So we try and offer as much as we can and give as much as we can to the people around us. And so, you know, I think it is important that those schools are opening and open to everyone because we want to build good relations. I really appreciate the point on this, you know, approach to social justice. We want that for everyone. And if we don't bring kids into our world to understand us, then we're going to keep doing the same kind of segregated work while we're trying to get there. Growing together is the best way to do it. And our teachers, you know, we have the wonderful pleasure of having a Alaskan and a licensed teacher, a corporate red uniform, because, you know, it's so powerful to have for that. She is denied, so it's even better. We have three teachers, a high school teacher, a preschool teacher, and we have a second to eighth grade teacher. So our preschool teacher is not native, preschool first grade, not native. Our second to eighth grade is Alaska Native, and our high school teacher is Vietnamese. So we are very all-inclusive with everyone, and I love that he's learning our Atma language. It's amazing. We have, you can see we have additional staff this year. We have COVID compliance and a cook, but they do the same job. We also have a 477 property manager, and I think this speaks to also what's important about tribal governance is that we can capitalize on our funding to create other programs that benefit our school. And that 477 program benefits our annual program, which again is open to everyone in the community and benefits our community. Our welfare system. And honestly, the best thing about our school is the volunteerism. We have so many people that volunteer to groom our ski trails, to buy, help us track down used skis and skis, to teach ski lessons, teach cross country. We have so many elders that come in and teach unique skills that you can't learn, you know, in a traditional school setting. Go ahead, next slide. It's not the language teacher. She's actually she taught for Mexico School District, so she has a teaching certificate, I guess.
We've had conversations about the type of impact, and I was just curious how well we have even the certification process.
Well, that's one of my topics I have in retail.
Can you talk a little bit about how staffing and
education, continue to understand the concepts around education and contacting. Is there an opportunity under a compact banner like for collective bargaining to continue?
I can envision that happening. I'm not an expert in that area, so I am more of a front of others. I know it's something we might not necessarily not entertain, we've just not yet entertained it yet. I do see, though, that it is easy to structure the different contracts within a contract, so I don't see it here.
Right, thank you so much, please
continue. That's it. So I just wanted to point out that what we're doing is working again. It's being recognized. We are Robert Wood Johnson finalists for a Pulitzer of Health Prize, and we're just up here overseeing and interviewing us about how we connect health to our school, to our community. And many, many people spoke out in response to this because I think it's so hard to describe, but that the school becomes the heart center of your community. And from there, people connect in and the school connects out. And the way it does that, it leaves this kind of healthy environment within a community. And it is helping in so many ways within our community. So I wanted to share that with you that, a lot of times we look at, I think, the tribal communities and we say, do they have the capacity or ability to do this? And what I'm saying is that, we believe it's successful, but other people are looking what we're doing very intensively. They interviewed us for 3 days, interviewed our partners for 3 days, and basically came to the conclusion that, what we're doing is working. It's something unique that is working. Go ahead and go to the next slide. So these are some of our challenges, and I will not manage to see them on the screen, but the first issue, I believe, is the sovereignty waiver issue. That, unfortunately, presents all sorts of challenges for us as a tribal government in partnering. I can tell you from my tribal government, we are eager to partner on projects. We have done more projects in our community. We've done all kinds of projects. But it always has to go through other third parties to actually formalize those agreements. And the state is really missing opportunities for collaboration, and it's all tied to this piece. Because in our constitution, we have no way of giving up sovereignty in any form, because it doesn't belong to us. It belongs to our children in the future. The second one, the BRE funding, we are not eligible for any BRE funding. What this means to us is that we piece together all sorts of funds. And what, contracting could offer is a centralized mechanism for doing this work and bringing them into schools that would then give more opportunity for government, tribal governments, or communities to actually spend less time doing this type of work. And this BRE funding issue is something that has really hamstring our ability to, it's a struggle to keep a school going. It really is a struggle. And sometimes our school has to ebb and flow with the funding as it comes in. And that's been really challenging for us. That's been one of the greatest challenges we've had. Every year, I spend a tremendous amount of time writing grants to fund our school. And operations are not easy to find. The shortage of well-estimated teachers, our solution to that is similar to what we were talking about previously, we're growing our own. So that young man who was in our school is now one of our teachers. One of our parents that was, her children went through our school is now our language teacher. Most folks are not licensed teachers, but they possess knowledge that you can't get in the Western educational system because they are not a language and culture expert. And recognizing that cultural knowledge is, I think, something we don't do well. I always jokingly say my educational background is in counseling psychology, where I say my really true education is from the elders, it's from working with the elders, from listening to the elders, and taking instruction from the elders. It was way more challenging to go through that educational process, and I got so much more out of it almost than I did my Western education.
Sure.
Thank you. I appreciate that as well. We did evaluate a charter school approach in the end in terms of the grant we got work for us. There are minimum standards of school size. It's very constrained. And after reviewing that with the school district and working it through, it wasn't an option that we were able to pursue. So those are challenges for us. You can go ahead and go to the next slide if there are no more questions. So these are my recommendations. Yes, we have to deal with that sovereign immunity issue. We need to engage with our congressional delegations to try to get that tribes receiving relief. And we also need to work to increase that funding allocation. We need to provide the flexibility so that Commissioner Johnson can actually truly negotiate with us. It is a government-to-government consultation, which means that, you know, it's a respectful dialogue. A lot can get done in those meetings. It's not a this situation. It's supposed to be meant to be a win-win situation. I guess I just don't think contracts work. We've been doing it a long time. You know, I see it as an excellent mechanism for fostering collaboration. I personally am really frustrated at where the collaboration is. And would like it to be richer and easier. It is difficult to collaborate. And I've been working for years on bridge building and how to do that work. And so contracting, I think, needs us to have this level where we can actually do better collaboration. Next slide.
Commissioner to enter into a contract. We're having some dialogue and developing some services. We had a presentation earlier in the year in this community on the Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Contract with the Department of Health and Social Services and tribes in Alaska on child welfare. And we understand that that work was really an executive initiative that began under the Walker administration, but the Deputy January Social has continued in his administration. Can you speak to the specific flexibilities that would be needed by the Department of Education with respect to the commissioner being able to engage in contracting? If the barriers are administrative or have they been statutory, is there any identification from the tribe perspective on what type of flexibility need to be offered there?
I think it's probably a little both, but I think a lot of it is administrative. You know, setting up the agreements. A lot of it is really recognizing that we need to allow communities to bring to you what they want to do, bring to the commissioner their plan. And then it's not so much as an approval process, it's more of an evaluated question answer process. And it gives, so when we go through the IHS contract process, what it does for me is I present my plan what I'm going to do. And we sit across from each other and we say, have you considered this? Have you considered how are you going to handle this? And so we may modify our plan and say, hey, that's a great idea, we'll add that in. Or we don't want to take that out because of these reasons. So it's this give and take that is supposed to be collaborative in nature. But the problem is you have to have the authority rest there so that if something outside of the box comes up, it is a great idea, but the commission can act on that great idea. And so, you know, how it has to be structured is that the And so it's not the state saying you can't do that, you're not allowed to do that, which is kind of what's happening now. You can't do this, you have to do this, and those, it's mushing our kids into these boxes. And I sit on the NDNA, the Equity Task Force out here in the Watson Borough, and we see the data flooding across that things are not working, you know, in some ways. So we've got to look at some different ways of not putting some of these kids, the school kids, in the round holes anymore.
So great. Thank you for that. And then a follow-up question. I know that Commissioner Johnson has been a big proponent of education compacting. How progressed have the discussions and dialogues been with the Department of Education in terms of working out the granular details of what education compacting would look like? Have there been opportunities where the Department of Ed have engaged in dialogues with tribes about
you know, I was involved in the very early stages of having this discussion through what it looks like and doing similar to what I'm doing now. And so from there, I know that there have been other groups meeting. I haven't necessarily been able to meet at all those meetings because I've been a COVID response person as well in our tribe. So I've been a little busy with that. And so I'm a little bit out of the apologize. I have to ask them that I've been meeting together. Next slide. I'm almost wrapped up here. I think the message I would say is that trust us, you know, we're good stewards of our resources. I can tell you our accounting department administration has had 17 years of clean audits, certified clean audits. No one that works for our tribal government ever wants to be the one that breaks that streak. And so, you know, we are transparent, we take our responsibilities of funding and stewardship of funding very seriously. Next slide. I just want to point out, this is the Lighthouse Community Health Center in Sutton that we helped build. This is another example of how once you build a school in a community, then you see what healthcare is in your community, and then you want other things within your community. And they kind of spread along out, and the supports that we build, the infrastructure we build then, translates into care for the entire community. This is a federally qualified community health center that serves our entire community out of sliding fee scale regardless of your ability to pay. And the important thing about this is connected to our school. Now, our kids planted apple trees for this building. Our kids go there many COVID times to work out in the gymnasium that's right there. Now, our staff goes down to the school to give lessons on different kinds of healthcare, mental care, all those things. So there's a bi-directional kind of support system built into the community right there. Next slide. And then this is also another example. We operate the only transportation system within our community and for the whole community, all the way from Chickling down to the corner. And that transportation system supports our school and those that they bring our children's school because we have a bus system. And so not only are they bringing our children, we're bringing all children, and we're also helping get people to work. Our staff uses it to get to work. So we have multiple tools that we're bringing in to our community to support our educational efforts. And I think that may be the last slide. Next. So I hope you take that opportunity to look at those, your book from last year. I think that will give you a good kind of sampling of where our school and really what it's about. And then, you know, just, I just hope we can find a pathway forward for those because I think, you know, we're both missing opportunities for collaboration and partnership that couldn't strengthen. And, you know, it will benefit Alaska as a whole if we can figure this out in our own lifetime, right? It could have been done a long time ago. But if we can figure this out, I think, you know, our goal in our school is to teach our kids to be inquisitive, to challenge them, to learn, to challenge themselves, to develop a love of learning, and be to grow up leaders, responsible, caring, compassionate future community members. I think that's what we're all about right there, right?
Thank you so much for your time this morning and your testimony and sharing a little bit of the vision that you had and that you've been able to work on over these years. Are there any final questions? Seeing none, Ms. Lee, thank you so much. I know that my office will be reaching out to you to stay in touch with you and the work that you're doing and also to gather feedback on the work that we're doing to make sure that we're able to help all of you the same things that you've touched on this morning. So, thank you so much for your time this morning.
And again,
this was just an initial conversation on opportunities related to education contracts, and we look forward to working closely with the department to bring them back, as well as certain other folks who have been able to participate in today's dialogue. Our next meeting for House Tribal Affairs will be on Tuesday, May 4th. We will be having a hearing on Crestville 184. Sponsored by myself relating to the Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact. The time is 9:37 p.m. and the Senate House Tribal Affairs Committee has now adjourned.